If you listen to the last few weeks of any political campaign in recent memory, I'm willing to bet you heard the phrase job creator over and over and over again. Because for so long, it's just felt like there weren't any jobs, or for that matter, job creation. But something's changing. Numbers are ticking up. People are being hired. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of December 12th, 2014. This week, we're talking about creation, creating jobs, paychecks, opportunities, new ways of thinking about old problems. As always, we want to hear about your creativity, so come talk to us online on our website, marketplaceweekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter, we're at MarketplaceWKND. Now let's start the show and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
43 million Americans have unpaid medical debt on their credit reports. That's according to a new report out today by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. About one in five credit reports contain medical debt that's been turned over to a collection agency.
When oil is falling and a strong dollar, that's generally good for stocks.
Breaking news, November retail sales headline numbers stronger than expected, up 7/10.
Throughout our show today, we are going to bring you several portraits of work in the current economy in three sectors: retail, manufacturing, and healthcare. Sectors the Labor Department says are creating jobs. We took the government's numbers and found human stories about what it means to work in America right now. Our first snapshot of job creation comes from someone who works for himself and does some hiring. His name is Farshad Arshid. He runs a clothing business with his wife, Sandy. They sell mostly sportswear and shoes. And we're starting in retail because that's where the economy is creating the most jobs right now. 50,000 jobs in the month of November alone, according to the Labor Department. Arshid started out on his own with one part-time employee a little over a decade ago. Now he owns three stores, two in Atlanta, one in Houston. He has a staff of around 15 employees, and it all started with a store called Standard.
What we were going to carry was not the standard, but we felt that it should be the standard. The topic of conversation was always, well, I got really these great things when I was in New York, or where I was in LA, or this or that, or there was almost this counterculture of people that are into these things. End of year two, we hired our second and third employee, if you will. I learned new things every day in this retail world. So one of the things I just found out recently is most corporate companies don't hire full-time salespeople anymore. They flood the floor with 10 or 12 or 15 part-time salespeople. I found this out when I was hiring for the G-Star Raw Boutique in Houston, and we had set up interviews with candidates, and not a single one of them was a full-timer, and they had two, maybe three jobs. And when I dug a little bit more, they said, you know, a store that was maybe comparable to our size, which was 2,000 square feet, would have 15 to 18 employees, but all worked an average of 10 to 12 hours a week, which is insane, the level of management that is going to require to run a staff of 18 people for a 2,000 square foot store. So we don't like to just hire cashiers and stock people. The customer wants to come in and see the same faces. They want to come in and connect with their favorite sales associate, the person who calls them when their favorite item is in. That happens only in a smaller environment. I started this when I was 29. I'm 41 now. So a 29-year-old thinks completely different than a 35-year-old, than a 41-year-old, or a 50-year-old. Well, I'm less than 9 years away from being 50. When you think that, it's like, wow, I mean, when did I get old, you know? So you can't help but to grow out of things. When we opened, in a million years, we never thought we would move away from sneakers. And now, right now, our footwear, I would say 80% of our footwear is non-sneakers. You can't dig your heels in, no pun intended, and say, I'm only going to do this thing. Because people change, styles change, people grow up. One of the things that I'm really, really into right now personally is denim. I'm obsessed with denim right now. I read about it on denim blogs, Japanese denim versus American denim, things like that. So yeah, there's so many different layers within this world that far be it for me to try to nail down what streetwear actually means, because it means so many different things to so many different people. Some people say that it was apparel that a lot of kids wore when they skated. A lot of people say that it was a certain street culture that people started to emulate in fashion, you know, high fashion now, if you notice. So it was sort of an element, sort of a style, but a lot of streetwear boutiques carried sneakers, and that's kind of what drove the lines, the camping outs and things like that. And we've had a few of those over the years. I want to be on the selling floor. I want to be involved with my staff. I want to be involved with my clientele. So I know when I go do the buy next season, I have a very good understanding of what my clientele are asking for.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Retail jobs like Farshad Ashid's are one of the places where we see a lot of jobs being created in this economy. And maybe even more importantly, Americans are starting to see their wages increase. A tiny amount, 0.4% in the past month. It may not sound like much, but Sarah Watthouse says that increase matters. She's an economist at Wells Fargo Securities. Remember, the middle class has had flat wages for so long, and this wage growth, well, it's something.
It is enough to keep up with inflation. So that's something that's really important when we look at, okay, putting that food on the table, filling up that gas tank, making sure your kids have clothes for the school year. It is a good number in that sense where we've seen inflation relatively low. But I think it's important to not just look at the average hourly earnings, but also look at how many hours people are getting. So one thing we saw in the last report is that the work week actually ticked up. While average hourly earnings are only up 2.1% over the past year, what workers bring home at the end of each week, that's a little stronger. It's up about 2.4%.
And that's always been something that people who study the jobs report and look at these numbers think of as a positive when they're reading the tea leaves, right? If, say, someone is keeping their workers around longer, that's often something that happens right before they hire a few extra folks.
Exactly. And so we like to see that work week ticking up. It's also a sign that maybe employers are hiring more full-time workers, which has been one of the issues we've seen in the labor market, where we still have a really high share of part-time workers. So the fact that we're seeing that work week extend a little bit is suggestive that, hey, maybe some of these workers are moving from part-time to full-time.
So many people, I think, are still so nervous about the state of the economy because it feels like, particularly relating to the jobs market, we're standing on quicksand. Like any gain could just slip away so quickly. Do you feel like what we've seen is firm ground, or is it still shaky?
I think we've really seen a firming over the past year, where we've had the strongest rate of job creation since the late 1990s. So this isn't just kind of the basic mid-phase of an expansion like we saw back in the 2000s. So I think the acceleration we've seen, where we've been consistently adding jobs at over 200,000 jobs for really the better part of this year, is a bit of a game changer.
We know, though, that the middle class has had a hard time paying for stuff. You know, their credit cards are stretched. We've replaced a lot of earnings with debt. So what kind of wage growth do we need to see to keep moving in a direction where people can pay for things?
Well, I think we've actually seen the consumer position get a little bit better in terms of how much they're using that credit card. But I think in terms of really boosting overall consumer spending, we would need to see an acceleration in wage growth. So essentially what your typical worker, okay, I've held on to my job, but I'm just not really seeing any increase in my paycheck that is improving my standard of living. I think we would need to see a breakout of that 2% range that we've been stuck in over the past few years to make people feel like they're actually improving their situation.
As an economy, we're hiring in retail, we're hiring in healthcare, we're hiring a little bit in manufacturing. Are we making the right kind of jobs to make up for what was lost in this recession?
Not entirely. So really where we've seen jobs come back has been at both the low end and the high end of the wage spectrum. Where we haven't seen as much improvement is some of those middle wage jobs. And so in terms of are we going to get the exact same jobs that we had in the 2000s? No. Some of those folks are going to get pushed down into lower income jobs, and that's going to be really tough for those households. But we are still seeing an improvement in some higher paying industries that are helping buoy wages and overall consumer spending.
Let's say you could create the perfect sort of fictive job, not even just what it was, but, you know, what would it pay? What kind of job would it theoretically be?
I think a fantastic job would be something where you don't necessarily need an advanced degree for, but it earns a very good paying wage. And so, you know, we've seen these typically in some blue-collar jobs like manufacturing or construction. Those do tend to be good jobs. But unfortunately, you know, for some folks, we are moving into a more bifurcated economy where we still need a lot of services provided that don't require many skills and therefore much education. But then we're also seeing a lot of jobs being created that require not only college degrees, but advanced degrees, specialized skills. I think that's been a big issue, and we'll probably see some of that continue.
Sarah Watthouse is an economist for Wells Fargo. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Coming up on the show, we asked how you budget for the holidays, and whoa, man.
Garlands, lights, and ribbons and stuff to put on the trees, yeah.
I guess I'm not opposed to maybe bringing a bottle of wine or something.
My mom sent me a Christmas tree, a little baby one, for my apartment, so I got the tree down.
I'm spending money on going home to see my family.
And our own Patty Hirsch explains job creation in a slightly different way. That's all ahead on Marketplace Weekend from APM. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of Marketplace Weekend. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years, and that couldn't have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate to Marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. Thank you so much for your support. When it comes to creating jobs, there are a lot of ways you can measure progress in individual stories or aggregate numbers like Sarah Watthouse talked about. Often it comes down to who you count and how you count. For a different way of looking at the jobs market, we're going to bring in Patty Hirsch. He's a senior editor at Marketplace and the host of the Marketplace Whiteboard. Welcome back, Patty.
Thank you very much, Lizzie.
We're going to talk about Jolts.
Jolts.
Not the cola.
No, not an energy drink.
Okay, so the formal name is the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. That is a serious mouthful, but what it tells us is that employers in the U.S. had 4.834 million job openings in October. Mm. Translate that for a normal human being. What does that mean?
Well, that means that's good news. It means that, you know, people are actually shifting out of work, which is great. If you've got churn in your job market, it means that people are leaving for one job and presumably going to another job. And that's great. That means you've got growth in all sorts of parts of the economy. People are hiring. All good news.
We had a guest earlier on the show talking about job creation. And one of the things that this report measures is how many people quit their job. Mm-hmm. So the rate of quitting actually decreased a little bit, mm-hmm. 0.1 percentage points to 1.9%. But it's at a pretty high level, the second highest level since June 2008. This is counterintuitive to people. Mm-hmm. Why is quitting so important?
Well, because if you feel that you can quit, it usually means because you think you can go into another job. it gives you an indication of how consumers and how employees are feeling. And if they're feeling good enough to quit, that they can get another job somewhere else, that means that they're feeling great about the economy. So that's a really good sign for the economy.
So we also have the news here that the ratio of unemployed job seekers to job openings fell in October to one of the lowest levels since February of 2008. This seems like pretty good news. And Sarah Whitehouse, who we had on the show, she is feeling like we are in a pretty good inflection point, but you have your arms in the air, shrugging.
Yeah.
Why are you making the meh face at me?
Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, these are great individual indicators. When you look at these, you think all of these sound really, really good. And on the surface of it, it looks great. But this is like the froth on top of the rotting Guinness, right? The pint itself doesn't taste particularly good. Because when you get in there, you know, although it looks great, you find out that in actual fact, the economy is not as good as it should be. The job market is not as good as it should be. Sure, these indicators look pretty good, but when you look at it en masse, when you look at it as a whole, we've still got a long way to go.
Are you talking about people who aren't counted as unemployed because they're not actively looking for a job, mm-hmm. or people who've got part-time jobs?
So these are what they call marginally attached workers. So this is all about these marginally attached people, people who've looked for work recently, but they're not looking currently, and those working part-time who would prefer full-time work. So these are people who, they've got jobs, but not really that great jobs. Or maybe they don't have jobs at all and they've dropped off the rolls, but they'd still like to have a job, thank you very much, but they're just not being counted. So, you know, when you look at that, really skews the market in a positive way, but not actually in a real way, if you want to look at the market as a whole.
You and I both know that Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed, pays attention to this JOLTS report. Mm-hmm. When she's asked, she says, yeah, that's the thing I like. Do you think the Fed is zeroing in on the jobs that are being created, or this still kind of sense of queasy weakness? Where are they?
I think it's totally with the queasy weakness side of things. They're saying that, yes, there is this great U3 number out there, the great number that people pay a lot of attention to, the one that gets all the headlines, and that number is looking a lot better. But they want to look at the JOLTS number, and they also want to look at the U6 number, these alternative numbers that give you a slightly different, more nuanced view of the labor market. And they're saying that when you look at those numbers, although the JOLTS numbers this week were good, in actual fact, the overall picture is not that great. And they're acknowledging this by saying that there's this widening gap between the reality of the labor market and its most well-known measure, this U3 number. And they're saying that we know this, and they're proving it by switching from this quantitative unemployment threshold to these more comprehensive measures of the labor market when they issue forward guidance, which is what they do a lot now.
Let's say you're a regular middle-class person and you don't pay a lot of attention to the JOLTS number or the jobs number. Where are you going to feel how the economy's doing right now?
I think you want to look at this labor participation rate, right? How many people are actually in the labor market right now? And if you look at that rate, it's actually really low, okay? It's declined steadily since the end of the recession, and it's as low today as it was in the late 1970s. I mean, it's basically stuck where it was at the end of 2013. It hasn't really moved all of this
year. So that means a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines.
It means a lot of people are sitting on the sidelines. They've dropped off the rolls. So there's a lot of people out there who are not working. They're actually, in many ways, subsisting off the government. This is not a healthy place to be. So I think that, if nothing else, if you look at that U3 number, the one that everybody telegraphs, you look at that, you want a pinch of salt to take with that, look at that labor force participation rate. That's what I would tell you to look at.
Patty Hirsch, Senior Editor at Marketplace, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You already heard a story about working in retail. Here's one about our second sector today, manufacturing. The Labor Department says 28,000 new manufacturing jobs were created last month. For decades, manufacturing was a way to make a solid living without a college degree. But it was hit hard by automation and offshoring. The Rust Belt narrative was not a happy one. The manufacturing jobs being created now are different, often specialized or regional. One plant leaves, another comes, bringing with it a few precious slots that don't always stay. Here's one story from Kenny Reeves. He's been working on and off in manufacturing in the South since he graduated high school in 2007.
You know, all my life I've worked around engines. I built engines. You know, we raced race cars over at the local track, you know, and that's what we did all our lives. So building engines was fun for me. Now, I probably wouldn't want to be a manufacturer for duct tape or something like that. My name is Kenny Reeves. I'm from Hartsell, Alabama. Right out of high school, I started with a company named ICE, which is Industrial Commercial Electrical. They didn't have no work, so I got laid off. After I went there, I went to a place called the Perry Company, which was an electrical place. Didn't work there long. Only worked there a few weeks because they definitely didn't have no work. I don't understand why they hired me. But after there, I went, can't remember the name. They moved that plant to Mexico. So I went to a place called Copeland, which was in Hartsell. They shut the plant down and moved it to Indianapolis, drawing unemployment in between a bunch of these jobs, too. They focus so much on the jobs that's been brought to Alabama. Like, I know of four or five big plants that's come, but yet we focus on that so much we haven't realized that four or five big plants has left. I mean, the radio host here, we was just talking of losing International Paper in Lawrence County and how it's affected the whole entire county and how the county is just going downhill right now because of it. I went to Toyota after I got laid off from Navistar. They was going to let me in, but they made me go through like a 5 or 6 step process in order to get hired on as a temporary worker. I mean, I had to do a written test. I had to do a computer test. I had to do a field test, a thorough medical exam and carpal tunnel test and all that. And it took like 3 or 4 weeks. And then at the end of it, I still didn't get on. So I guess there's so many people going after the job now, they really want to dwindle down to make sure they get good workers. I enjoy making things with my hands. And whenever the economy crashed in 08 to 09 to 2010, there was just no jobs. There was no work being done. I mean, there was nothing being built. I mean, nobody had no money to build. So in my perspective right now, manufacturing is a great opportunity. They pay good. You cannot make no more money anywhere else. I mean, they pay the best money there is for someone that don't have a degree. And, you know, they take care of you far as insurance and stuff like that and give you good vacation, good benefits. At Navistar, I was building diesel engines for semi-trucks. Basically, I worked a station or two to put different parts on the engine when it got to my station. 3 years of my life, you know, I enjoyed doing it. And, I mean, I got a lot of stuff accomplished with the money that I made there. So I've seen the jobs come, but I've also seen the jobs go.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. And for some of us, it's a low-tech world, at least in some areas, like the kitchen. So what's in yours?
Technology in my kitchen. The blender?
Coffee maker?
Can't say I use anything except maybe for the coffee machine. I don't cook much.
Nutribullet.
George Grill. We have a grill.
Yeah, timers. And then thermometers. Ovens.
I really try to stay away from the kitchens.
It's like those like mini blenders that you would just go ahead and it's like a big cup and you throw everything in there and you just like press down on it and blends everything.
Microwave. A rice cooker.
Drawers and drawers of gizmos and stuff.
I've got a fancy bottle opener. That's kind of about it.
The blow torches? Yeah, that's what I call them. Is that what you call them?
Blowtorch?
I have three of them, yes. You're just interested in blow torches?
As far as technology goes in my kitchen, I'm pretty much a microwave guy. I'm very good with the microwave. I would call myself a microwave expert, actually. If it can be microwaved, I can do it. And I've learned lessons. I've become an expert after burning down a couple kitchens. Aluminum, not in the microwave. Spoons, also not in the microwave. I know that now. Yeah.
So how is kitchen tech changing? Let's find out.
Today we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
I'm Julia Child. All you need to make an omelet is a hot fire, and you need some butter, some salt and pepper, and some eggs.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
We are in the kitchen, or you're in the kitchen.
I'm in the kitchen. I'm you're sort of in the kitchen.
Kind of in the kitchen of our senior producer, Dan Semitovich. We're in New York, which means that this kitchen is...
This is a New York City kitchen, for sure.
It's my
great aunt would call this a one-butt kitchen.
Okay, all
right. Fits one butt in it.
I feel you. What are we doing here in the kitchen?
So we're experimenting with a new tool. We're not quite making coffee, but we're going to play with something that makes coffee. Now, do you know what this is, this thing that I'm holding?
A tiny little lightsaber?
It kind of does look like a lightsaber, but it's basically a milk frother.
Okay.
So it's sort of like a little handle, and it's got a switch on it. It's basically on and off.
Ooh.
And that's it on, and it's got this little, what would you call this, like a circular whiskey thing on the end, about the size of a dime. So, you know, when we go to coffee shops, there's all kinds of fancy drinks that we can get, and we love those fancy drinks, and more, technology is allowing us to do some of this stuff at home, and this is an example of that. Right now, we're going to make a little foamed milk, a little frothy milk, and I've got here this Easy Latte Milk Frother. That's the sound of $14.99 right there. It's not too expensive. It's pretty cheap. Should I try and froth some milk?
It sounds like an infomercial. Yeah. Froth some milk for me, man.
All right, cool. This is, of course, almond milk
in
true public radio fashion. But it's working pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you see it's getting bubbly there. If you wanted some froth on your milk, there you go. What's interesting about this, too, is this claims it can be used to stir up eggs for, you know, scrambled eggs, whip up eggs, stuff like that. And, you know, I don't know how long it'll last, but it's an interesting little tool, right?
Okay, so that's one little thing. You have that in your hand.
Right.
The idea of big kitchen tech coming down to little kitchen scale, that's kind of happening with other stuff too, yeah?
Absolutely. So I have an immersion blender at home, which I never would have imagined that I would own something like that, but they're relatively cheap now. Something that's really happening a lot right now because people are excited about it is sous vide. Do you know sous vide?
I do.
Yes.
Je parle français.
Yeah. So sous vide is this way of cooking food where you immerse stuff into this warm bath of water that's perfectly held at a certain temperature, and it perfectly cooks this thing that's in a vacuum sealed bag, right? Whether it's steak or broccoli or whatever.
And that's now kind of scaled down to tiny kitchen size?
These sorts of things are starting to be scaled down. Now, sous vide was, you know, if you buy a restaurant version of one of these things, it costs $1,000. And it's a kind of a fancy thing, right? But these days, you can find sous vide machines that are like $200, $300, and it'll do a really good job in your home. We're seeing a lot of trickle down here, this trickle down effect of professional kitchens using expensive technology to make a ton of food, but now people being able to do similar things in their home at, I would say, pretty comparable quality.
What else is out there?
Well, there's actually a lot of different kinds of things. I've seen crowdfunded blow torches so that you can actually brulee your creme brulee, for instance. I've seen fancy coffee grinders, cold brew equipment. That's a big thing now. Cappuccino makers. All this stuff is becoming affordable at home. And this is happening, I would say, in part because cooking shows and media are driving demand, driving interest. That drives companies to manufacture stuff that the home cook can afford.
This goes a little farther, though, than devices. I mean, we're also talking about the techier part of this, which is the wired kitchen, the Internet of Things.
Yes. So I don't know. Have you heard of the Egg Minder?
What's that?
This is a smart egg carton that tells you which eggs are freshest.
Wait, really?
Yes. And when your eggs go bad, when you need to get new ones, there are smart cutting boards out there. People are starting to build things like this. Then, of course, I don't know if you've heard of the Amazon Echo. It's that thing that sort of you put in your house. It's a little creepy, but you put it in your house and it listens to you, but it can also help you complete recipes and cook at the table, things like that.
Wow.
A lot of people who cook at home are already using their phones or tablets in the kitchen to read recipes or look at instructional videos online, right? This is all part of the Internet of Things. And it's about to get even weirder.
Like that refrigerator, but wired?
Yes, that refrigerator, but wired, the kind of thing where your fridge and your television talk to each other, for instance. So your television knows what you usually have in your fridge and it can deliver you advertisements for things you're getting low on, for instance. Or maybe your fridge will ping your phone when you leave the house and say, hey, you usually have butter inside of me and now there's no butter. So you might want to pick up some butter while you're out.
Wow. So I will never again wander the grocery store shelves wondering what it is I forgot.
That's right.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. Visit us on the web at marketplaceweekend.org. You can download our podcast in the iTunes store or tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. Throughout the show, you've heard people tell their stories of working in three fields that are creating jobs. We've talked about retail and manufacturing. Now we're going to turn to healthcare. It's growing steadily, in part because baby boomers are aging. Even throughout the recession, healthcare was a bright spot when other fields were shrinking. And in November, 37,000 healthcare jobs were created, again, according to the Labor Department. Wages in health and education, that's how the government tracks them, are also going up, even if the pay remains below jobs in, say, manufacturing. When Jamie Grigsby became a nurse, she found it pretty easy to get a job.
Healthcare in general, the market for a job was wide open at the time. So pretty much when you graduated, there was going to be a job, not only a job, but a well-paying job waiting for you. When I graduated with my undergraduate degree, I had a lot of friends who went into different careers and had a difficult time finding a job, but I didn't have that issue. I wanted an office setting, didn't necessarily want to be in the hospital. I wanted to work in an office setting so I could work a Monday through Friday job, and I found that immediately after graduating. Now it's a lot different than when I graduated. Now it's very difficult to find those specific jobs, and the pay is a lot less. Most of the time now, when you graduate with an RN, you're pretty much going to start out in the hospital setting, and those hours are a little bit more difficult. 12-hour shifts, weekends, holidays, that kind of stuff. When I graduated, I did not run into that issue. The way that healthcare is trending now, the insurance companies like for patients to see nurse practitioners. They feel that the education and training is there, but they can reimburse a less amount compared to a physician. So the field is expanding for nurse practitioners, and the future is bright for us. I like the autonomy. I have a lot of decision-making abilities when it comes to seeing my patients. At the same time, I collaborate with the physician. So if I have a patient or a case that I'm not quite sure about, I can collaborate with my physician and he can guide me into the direction that I should be going. Alabama is one of the states that is slower as far as giving more privileges to nurse practitioners. We are one of the states that don't have prescribing privileges for narcotics, so that slows us down a little bit. In a lot of other states, the organization is lobbying for more privileges, and in Alabama, we're lobbying as well, and we're making progress. We're getting there, so in the future, I do think that it's going to be a lot better. When my degree increased, when I went from a bachelor's degree to a master's degree, the pay almost doubles. With the more experience that you have, the more experience that I have, the pay has went up as well.
Our show on job creation this week focused on a few growing industries: retail, manufacturing, and healthcare. As our economy changes, so does the way it feels to us. Not just in terms of numbers, but at a more palpable level, at our dinner tables, gas stations, and malls. We want to hear more about what the economy feels like to you in your home, your workplace, or your search for a job. Tell us your stories. You can write us at marketplaceweekend.org or tweet us. We're at @MarketplaceWKND. Last week, we asked you to tell us your stories about the hidden cost of the holidays and whether and how you budget for them. Here's what you're saying.
I like Christmas, so I go all out.
We don't really have room for a tree and lights. And
I bought some lights. Probably won't go all out just because I didn't get the money for it.
My fiancé and I are getting married next month, so we're trying to actually save instead of spend too much money for the holidays. So I sound very cheap.
Well, yeah, I just went to an ugly sweater party. So I went to the store, got an ugly sweater, and I knew I wouldn't be wearing it again. So I kept the tags on, and then I took it back.
Well, garlands, lights, and ribbons and stuff to put on the trees, yeah.
I guess I'm not opposed to maybe bringing a bottle of wine or something.
My mom sent me a Christmas tree, a little baby one, for my apartment. So I got the tree down.
I'm spending money on going home to see my family.
Jewelry. I never buy jewelry, but I buy jewelry for my mom. This is present.
Yes, presents. So lots and lots of presents and decorations for the house.
There's usually like a party I have to go to that I forget about until last minute, and I have to get something like champagne or usually booze.
Yeah, booze. Yeah, mostly. I mean, that's where most of my money kind of ends up going when I think about it. I don't really buy things other than that, you know?
I don't really budget for the holiday, no.
I got some family coming into town, so we'll probably just have a good time. That's where all my money's going. Gifts.
Yeah, plane ticket back to Australia.
Like more lighting?
Throughout the year, I'll save money. So by the time I reach the end of the year, I will just splurge.
Lauren Lyons-Cole is a contributor to The Street and a certified financial planner, and she joins me now to talk about all of this. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
We heard that one voice saying, I don't really budget. I'm guessing that is not something that you look all that fondly on.
That immediately jumped out at me, and I thought, it's the holiday season. It's the most important time to budget. And I know it's way more fun to get caught up in the spirit of it all, but at the end of the day, when it becomes January and we have to answer for the spirit of it all, that can be stressful.
So how do you do it?
We're a little bit late into the season now, but hopefully people have already
looked. Not if you shop like I do.
Good point. And actually me too. So for those of us who haven't started spending too much yet, there's still time to look and see how much extra income do we have in December? What do you have in your savings account that you can responsibly put towards holiday shopping? And there are some little tricks, actually, ways that you can expand your holiday budget. One of my favorite ones is to cash in on your rewards points for your credit cards. Americans actually let about $200 on average go unused every year. And $200 is a good, you know, something to contribute towards your budget. And I've actually done this trick with a few people so far, and I've seen that. I actually had one guy who had almost $1,000 in rewards
points.
Wow. Yep. So look at your rewards points. Maybe there's some money there.
There was a survey from Sears and Kmart. They did a survey of 1,000 adults in November, and it indicated that 34% of Americans plan on spending $100 or more this year on decorations. That seems like a tremendous amount of money on decorations. And maybe that's just, you know, imposing my own framework on something. But when you talk to people about getting in the holiday spirit, where do you see their money go?
I'm with you on the decorations. But I do think there's sort of this pressure to enjoy the season. And there's something about having a tree or, you know, whatever it is that you decorate with that makes you feel like it's the holiday season.
Competitive neighborhood lighting.
Oh, well, I mean, how can you not compete with those sorts of things? It's something to win at. That's a lot of money to put towards just making your apartment or your home look a certain way.
You heard some of our listeners there talk about booze, right? Alcohol being a very expensive thing. There's also food. Contributing to, say, a family potluck, you know, even a party for friends. How do you budget for those kind of expenses?
If you're going to have to go to a lot of parties, this might be a good time to think about buying in bulk. Go get a case of wine, pick out something you really like, it's not too expensive, that has a label that looks expensive, and get a discount for buying, you know, 12 at a time. And that way you're ready. And if you forget about a party, you can just go to your box. And then if you have some left over for January, all the better.
Yay. we've looked at the jobs numbers this week in our show, and there's always a pickup in retail hiring. And I have a friend who's taken on extra shifts at a store this year to sort of supplement her income. Is that a good way to offset, you know, what you want to be purchasing in the holiday season?
It can be, but I think the important thing, obviously, if you do start working in a retail situation, you're going to get discounts, which you'll probably use maybe for gifts or whatever. So it's a good time to really evaluate how much will you end up spending as a result of taking on that job and do a cost-benefit analysis, because there could be other ways to make money as well. I mean, you could also sell things that you've created on Etsy. It's a great time for that. Or even if you have leftover gift cards laying around, you can sell those online for cash. So there's different ways to drum up money if you need it.
What am I not thinking about? You know, when you talk to people about their finances, what do you know that's under the surface that we're not, that we don't consider?
You know, I think the holiday season, there's in line with the decorations and the gifts and needing extra money and not budgeting and booze. I mean, this is a stressful time of year, as enjoyable as it is and as much as it's fun to be around friends and family, there's also a lot of pressure to spend. And I think people can feel out of control with that. So it is, if it's possible, it's a good time to really take an hour to yourself, maybe on a Saturday morning, and look over your finances and just make sure that you're not getting to a place where it's going to feel out of control, truly, when you have to face it in January.
Lauren Lyons-Coltz, a certified financial planner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Next week on Marketplace Weekend, we're talking about algorithms. Some of the algorithms that affect our lives the most are the ones airlines use to determine flight prices and the best days for ticket sales. We want to hear your stories about travel, how you make it work for you financially, and how you work the system. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. This week, we're talking about creating, growing, or making something from nothing. Near Albany, New York, there's a company called Ecovative. They create packing materials, furniture, and even surfboards out of mushrooms and recycled farm waste, and they can make a lot.
Protective packaging materials, surfboards, hand planes, furniture products, construction materials, including insulation, helmets. And now we enable people to grow their own materials in their kitchens with our Grow It Yourself kit.
Ecovative wants to compete with large manufacturing companies. Co-founder and chief scientist Gavin McIntyre says they want to do that without toxic chemicals.
We started this company because we recognized a problem, which was that plastic foams and synthetic resins were literally everywhere, and they were poisoning our environments and poisoning our homes. So we sought to find a natural alternative by looking to nature.
Was there a eureka moment when you realized, oh my God, we can make this thing?
Eben and I did go to school together at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. So we initially took some mushroom spawn, is what it was called at the time, off the internet. It's just traditional oyster mushrooms at that point in time. Mixed it with some wood chips and other materials, and we grew the first materials under our beds in our school dorm rooms. And after we had those materials in hand, we had them tested at our university, and we found that they actually benchmarked and were pretty competitive performance-wise against plastic foams. And that's what set our trajectory into growing materials.
How did that feel?
I'll tell you, it feels pretty awesome. It's been 7 years now. We started in the basement of an old print shop, and now we have a product that's being distributed all around the world. Really, the big moment for determining that this was a commercially viable product was when our first customer was a Fortune 500 furniture company. Steelcase Furniture was the first company to adopt this material.
Did you celebrate?
Of course we celebrated. I think there was at least a couple of bottles of champagne. And that day, it was a full 8-hour day. There were about six of us operating the equipment, and we made about 300 parts, which, to give you an idea, we make over 300 parts in an individual hour today. We had cake, which is something that we did regularly, because with such few people, you can celebrate everyone's birthday, and that was definitely a, an event that called for more cake. Now, since we're a larger company, we don't offer as much beer, but we definitely drank beer and champagne to celebrate.
We're talking about creating on this show, and we've been talking about jobs and the new economy. What is next, do you think? Where do you want your company to go in another 7 years?
We really see ourselves as a materials science company and a materials provider. And similar to Dow and DuPont, who were the materials leaders within the 20th century, we seek to be the biomaterials leader in the 21st century. Our focus today is within replacements for plastic foams that are found everywhere in protective packaging to even surfboards. And we have a new product offering, which is replacing some of the resin found in engineered wood composites in the furniture industry.
But say, you know, let's compare what you make to traditional styrofoam. What's the price differential?
When a customer is going to buy a product, they're looking at price and performance. And the environmental story is a nice to have, but it's not a need to have. All of our product offerings are at price parity or below traditional plastic foams or woods. So we've been able to translate and transfer customers that have been using plastic foams for a long duration of time, especially as they open up new opportunities and new products that they're bringing into the market.
Who are your customers?
So we have a wide range of customers that include companies such as Dell Computers or Crate and Barrel Furniture. These are customers that require protection in transportation for their products, but are also looking for a material that isn't going to be hazardous at its end of its life cycle when it returns to the earth.
And I guess one question I have is, why surfboards?
So surfboards are a bit of a passion project. I grew up actually on Eastern Long Island. And whenever looking at places where plastics, especially custom molded plastics, are being used, surfboards is one that has always come to my mind. We have a material offering that we call Grow It Yourself. It's our material in which we allow individuals to grow their own materials within their either garages or their kitchens. And since surfboards are an artisanal market, they're normally hand-shaped, we've been able to offer this Grow It Yourself kit to surfboard shapers to grow their own boards. So we have a number of companies, mostly on the West Coast today, that are literally growing surfboards.
You're making this material, you're making surfboards, you're even making a drone. What is next for biodegradable plastics and these materials?
Well, our next wave of product offerings is actually in the furniture industry. You're probably sitting at a desk right now, Lizzie, and that desk is likely made out of medium-density fiberboard in the core. So it's predominantly wood, but it's bound together with a synthetic resin that's known to be carcinogenic, urea or formaldehyde. So what we've been able to do is use mycelium again, but this time as a thermoset resin, and to transform traditional farm waste materials into products that preform and behave just like wood. So we've been able to produce chairs. The chair I'm sitting on right now, for example, is comprised about 10% of its total out of mushroom materials. It looks like wood, it feels like wood, but it's made out of mushrooms.
Gavin McIntyre, co-founder and chief scientist at Ecovative, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And that's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Jenny Ament. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll talk about how algorithms impact our lives and wallets. Plus, we'll talk about plane travel and hear your stories of holiday trips. Thanks for listening. This is APM.